So, hello and welcome to the third talk in a small series of talks which were composed around this small presentation about the Silk Museum and the new publication of the Silk Museum Seria, as well about the concept of digitalization of the archive of the museum. I'm very happy to introduce Nina Achletyani. She is based in Tbilisi and is a curator, not only. I met her as a curator, and she was helping very much to make this project possible and in a several levels. Not only as a curator you would expect, like curators normally working, it was also on the conceptual level, very intensive dialogue between us, but as well Nina founded an initiative which was extremely helpful in a very pragmatic sense, because she founded a platform for the digitalization of archives. And when we had a chance with the help of Goethe Institute to think about to digitalize the photo collection or the glass negative collection of the Silk Museum, Nina's initiative was extremely supportive, not only by digitalizing it, also to create the standards which helps the museums to exchange these collections on a museum standard. So that was really something what was a new level also for making this archive accessible, not only for the people in Tbilisi and for the museum itself, but you will see in the future that this archive can circulate for the research in the scientific community, wherever, because of this way how it was digitalized. So I think Nina will talk about DINEPA in a wider sense, because it is not only for this archive. I met Nina also as a curator or as a member of the board of the Kakabadze Foundation, David Kakabadze. We were talking this morning about him as a very influential artist, a Georgian artist but based in Paris and in Tbilisi. And the whole influence what we tried to sketch out this morning, I want not to repeat again, but just to say it is also a link to the avant-garde and to the understanding of avant-garde in a different way, which not only is a traditional Western focus on the avant-garde project of the early 20th century. As well, Nina was, as a curator, very supportive to help me to create this artistic project of the magazine Seria, which we present here, for the Silk Museum. So this is number one copy, and you see on the table number two, and there already in the number two you see the help of this kind of digitalization, because the motifs of this copy in there come from the archive of the Silk Museum, which was before just known to some people, and they were never published that way. So this is a series which will now go on. The museum will use it as well for their scientific papers, as well for initiatives what they are doing with artistic projects, and also I hope, as the second issue is pointing out, with poetry, because the subtitle of the Seria is Sericulture Station, Papers, Research, Poetry, Archive. So all these four fields are interconnected, and when you see the title of this talk through the words of others, it sounds very poetical. And I think we not listen only to poetry, but as I said this morning, knowledge and poetry are not different kinds of thinking. They are more or less interconnected. And I think that poetry is a very certain specific knowledge where you cannot have access to the other kind of knowledge. But this is my personal view. So I hand it over to Nina. I'm very happy that she is here, that all the people who came from Georgia, also from the Silk Museum, the director is here, that they were able to come, especially in this very difficult times. It's very important to see that there is a kind of community here, and that also this, what you see here, has very much to do with a national identity and very much also with making this visible. And this is also what we're talking about when we talk about archives. And then there's another thing what I think Nina will talk about as well. We think very often about archives, when I say we, I mean the people in Central Europe, in relation to institutions. We have a very institutionalized, at least when I see all the talks which are given, concept of archives. But the main part of the world has a totally different concept of archive. What we call archives are there in very different formats. They are sometimes only accessible on a very private level. They are sometimes just maintained by the families. They are sometimes maintained by friends. So they have a very informal status. They are not institutionalized at all. And what happens to these collections, what happens to these kind of possible knowledge, that is a crucial question in these days. So when we in the West starting to think about as a act of freedom to deconstruct archives and to mix them up, on the other side, we should never forget that first you need an archive to deconstruct it. And the first you need to get a kind of knowledge which forms an identity before you play around. So that is what I wanted to say as a short introduction. I'm very happy that you're all here. I hand it over to Nina. And I also hope very much that later, you know, a Q&A, or we are also here if you have more questions about the exhibition or about what Nina is presenting. Very welcome. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I am very happy to be here. I will also make a little intro. I was involved in the exhibition, as Olaf has mentioned. That is, the title of the installation is called Spindful, Here Again, Casting an Echo of Architecture of Sericulture, which is presented here as part of the exhibition Archives and Imaginaries. I was also lucky to be selected and to participate in the Whole Life Academy program. There are some of my colleagues here present attending this talk. I'm very happy about that because for a couple of months we've been exchanging research and interacting on a very interesting level. And now I'm very lucky to be here as part of these three talks that we have arranged in relation to the installation that we have here presented. I have to thank Olaf for this amazing introduction because he already touched upon some points which I will be elaborating more in the talk. And so the idea was to dedicate this session and introduce archive practices in Tbilisi, Georgia, through a variety of research fragments and visual resources that have the potential to develop into multi-relational contextual links. I will consider in relationships with artists, curators, and archives, and suggest how they can engage actively with archive materials in order to open them up to new and productive encounters. And I have to tell you a bit about the context where I'm coming from and what I will be talking about. The turbulent aftermath of the dissolution of the Soviet Union has complicated the structures and accessibility of Georgian archives. Several fires have destroyed important collections, and including those of the National Center of Art History and the Georgian National Film Studio archives as well. Apart from theft and arson, additional impediments resulted from artists' estates and families being rarely open to collaborations, open to research, and also to lending artworks for exhibitions. And whereas public institutions, for their part, are hesitant to disclose that any of their materials in their collection may have been damaged, vanished, or uncatalogued at this point. So this is the context we're dealing with. And to address these limitations and vulnerabilities, we founded this initiative, DINEBA, which Olaf has mentioned already. And this independent archive initiative provides in-depth art historical, archival, and research-specific support to academics, artists, and curators. By assisting them in tracing documents, utilizing sources, and conducting research in archives. We study, categorize, and digitize artworks, art-related objects as well in archives, obviously, in accordance with particular project interests and proposals that we get. So we don't have a fixed program at this point. And this serves as a foundation for long-term record keeping and allows us to provide support that's responsive, reciprocal, and integral as part of the projects. Our team has been for 3 years now working with the David Kakabadze Foundation and their collection and archives. I will introduce the artists briefly also share fragments of research related to his archives that have come up during the work with this material. David Kakabadze was an avant-garde painter, graphic artist, a scenic designer. He was also a polymath, a historian of art, a pioneer of cinematography, and an amateur photographer. He was thoroughly documenting his scientific research, leaving extensive notes behind on his electrotechnical experiments and the stereoscopic cinematic experiments, which I will elaborate more soon. And he also began publishing initiatives. One of his first publications was published in 1919. It was an interdisciplinary journal, which had four sections, topics. It was related to literature, art, science, and political observations. Later on, same year, in 1919, he moved to France, and there he continues his publishing activities, as well as he shows in multiple exhibitions, including the Salon des Indépendants, as it was called at that time. So, what I would like to say is related to this slide. It's an opening slide, but I will come back to it. It's this invention of his, which was invented 1924. Kakabadze invents a stereoscopic film projector. And this film projector is used to facilitate 3D cinema and to develop cinematography in general. And he was working on this scientific project while living in Paris, concurrently with his artistic practice and the research that he was conducting there. And he did, in fact, obtain several patents for this invention from different countries. And he was given a huge grant at that time to develop his prototype and put it into production. However, he did not manage to do this, so he had this one particular machine which did work, as we know, from different sources, but he at some point stopped working on this project. However, it is interesting to note, that I go back to this slide, that the leftover materials that he used for the scientific invention, leftovers from the factory itself where he was working, then he later incorporated into his artistic practice. And especially in this series of constructive compositions where he used metal, glass, reflective surfaces and wires, everything that was related to his optical experiments somehow ended up in his artwork. So I'll show you another example. It's this one, for example. So you can see how already in 1924 he was experimenting with the possibilities of incorporating these types of materials in his art pieces. So, and this, I think this study of his of the scientific research later resonates throughout his life in many different ways, and I will try to explain that as well. I will not talk too much about his artworks, but I will mention that in 1936 there was a manifesto published by the Dimensionalists. They had an exhibition in Paris with this manifesto presented there in the show, and the participants who signed the manifesto included Naum Gabo, Duchamp, Kandinsky, Picabia, Pablo Picasso, Sonia Delaunay, Miro. So many artists were involved in this show, and the initiator of this manifesto was Charles Cirato. I will read a fragment from this manifesto. explain why I'm using it in this presentation. So the dimensionist's tendency has led to, it says in this text of, as you see here on the screen, the tendency has led to literature leaving the line and entering the plane, calligrams, typograms, planism, electric poems, painting quitting the plane and entering space, painting in space, constructivism, spatial constructivism, polymaterial constructions, sculpture stepping out of closed, immobile, dead forms, that is, out of forms conceived of in three-dimensional Euclidean space, in order to appropriate for artistic expression Minkowski's four-dimensional space. It is above all a slot sculpture, classical sculpture, that has opened itself up first to inner space, then to movement, and it transferred into perforated sculpture, open sculpture, mobile sculpture, motorized objects, and after this, a completely new art form will develop, cosmic art, the vaporization of sculpture. So with this note, I wanted to just make a brief connection to Kakabadze's work in general. I think this sums up his practice, so I think I would leave it at this, at that, his period and his work from Paris period. The manifesto included Kakabadze's name as well, that's why I'm bringing it in this talk, but without his actual signature, because of the Iron Curtain that had divided him from his colleagues in the West by then, he was not able to sign the document himself, the manifesto. This is remarkable given that Kakabadze's interaction with the outside world had been hampered by the closed borders since his return to Soviet Georgia in 1929, and attests to his work's continued relevance until well into the 1930s. We were delighted to learn that his family had preserved his archives and the majority of his artworks. Only a few art historians have had access to the material over the last 60 years, and he has only had one worldwide solo exhibition outside of Georgia in 2015 at the Mayol Museum in Paris. Our team at Dineba, we are still working on the archives, and we benefited from the fact that the physical archive materials had not been disassembled or separated from one another as they likely would have been if they had been institutionally conserved. Some of the archive materials remained in their original individual envelopes, and I show you the house where the material is kept and was kept. Now we also have a chance to work on it in our own space with the archivists. Then this is the context where for so many years this material was kept and conserved. And this is a selection of material related to his scientific work, part of an exhibition we curated in 2019, specifically about his archives in Tbilisi. And the interesting thing is that the fact that these materials were handed to us in forms of envelopes, we could see that the artist had his own classification schema that was retained in the archive. And we examined these archive practices, his archive practices, gradually discovering that he was primarily interested in archiving information and documents pertaining to his scientific work. And his work that he created in Paris. So he was archiving his work from that period. As soon as he came back to Georgia, he really wanted to conserve this information. And on the other hand, he was omitting entirely his later information about his later work and his large-scale commissions for the Soviet Socialist Republic of Georgia, for public events, the commissions that he was getting. His architectural camouflage of the building housing the National State Museum is one such example, exception as well. This is the only public commission revealing an entirely different aspect of his artistic practice that he has documented and archived. And this is 1931 that he had this large-scale project that he was able to realize. We can now trace materials and interpret coincidences and echoes arising from concurrent curatorial and research projects that we're working on, which brings me to one specific example, a connection between Kakabadze and a Soviet archaeologist and inventor of theory of linear or gestural speech, Nikolai Marr. Marr's work appears to have been largely forgotten, although the Georgian-born author is best known for his theory of language, also known as Japhetic theory, and Marr's work on the disciplinary margins, his invention of new fields of knowledge, and his archaeological vision of history are gradually being rediscovered, most notably by an author and a curator, which I've, Elena Vogman. I've been encountering her research quite often recently about Marr, and one of her texts is titled Language Follows Labor, Nikolai Marr's Materialist Paleontology of Speech, which was published in 2021. And I must mention that Elena Vogman is also participating in the Congress, as I found out. So it would be interesting to hear what she's working on at the moment. And I reference information which I, from her text as well. So Nikolai Marr worked from 1923 to 1934 to reclaim the history of language, particularly the history of oral languages. This was distinguished by an extraordinary transfer of his archaeological experience to the field of language theory and culture. The letters and correspondences from the Kakabadze Foundation archives reveal the ways in which Kakabadze aided Marr in his publishing initiatives, helping him publish his critical theories and research articles. Kakabadze had himself also in turn written about the concept of art as language that transcends space and time, and believe that Eastern and Western unity is critical, as is the acceptance of all artistic achievements dating all the way back to prehistoric times. This may be why in 1929 Kakabadze began making a film. These are some of his sketches, preparatory sketches also, which are related to the film. These are sketches, scenes from the film, and the film was about the monuments of Georgian material culture. And he worked on this from 1929 to 1931. And the film shows the Georgia's material culture from prehistoric times to the 18th century. He explored architecture, but also sculpture and painting, including mosaics, frescoes, and reliefs. The film's premiere was held in 1931, and according to Russia's State Committee for Cinema, the film failed to fulfill its propaganda purpose, so it was banned, and later the film vanished. What's left behind is a sketchbook of these sketches related to the film, as well as more than 100 photographs, which were also preparatory work for the film and the script. However, recently we did discover negatives, which you see here at the moment. These negatives were of the film strips, original film strips. And we found these negatives when we were preparing material for an exhibition in Rome at Villa Lontana. This exhibition took place last year from May till July, and it was part of a group show titled Painting Stone. And it was the foundation itself that expressed interest to conceptualize these photographs from the negatives as part of a bigger group show with contemporary artists as well. Whoops. Sorry. I think we should put on a film. So we believe that this extensive research into Georgian cultural heritage sites, as well as the optics of his stereoscopic film projector, was carried over into his artistic works, paintings, and collaborative cinematographic projects with other Georgian film directors. I must warn you, the film has a very intense visuals, disturbing visual material, but I did specifically choose this fragment to elaborate on what I'm trying to say, basically. So the film, it was produced in 1931. Its title is Salt of Svaneti. The director was Mikhail Kalatosishvili, and the artist on the film was David Kakabadze. And Kakabadze was sharing his knowledge at that time. He was much older than a young film director, and he was sharing his knowledge, not only related to optics and stereoscopy and this in relation to cinema, also his knowledge in relation to the cultural heritage and material culture. And we can start the video. And this film is about the Svans who live in the mountainous regions of Georgia. It's a documentary, also fiction, that employs experimental camera work. In his text, Methods of Screening, published in 1929, the director of this film, Kalatozishvili, refers very much to theories of Kakabadze, a bit indirectly, so it's a bit of my elaboration that he's very much already at that point influenced by Kakabadze's theories, as well as Sergei Eisenstein. The images of Kakabadze's artworks, Constructive Compositions, which I mentioned earlier, were published in the same journal as the text by Kalatozishvili about cinematography. Salt of Svaneti was shot concurrently at the same period when Sergei Eisenstein was working on his epic unfinished film Que Viva Mexico from 1931, which also incorporates rhythmical repetition and emerging new anthropological historical perspective inspired by Nicolai Marr's theories and works. Eisenstein attended his lectures in the 1920s at St. Petersburg Jephthah Institute, which was affiliated with the State Academy of History and Material Culture in St. Petersburg. Both films, this as you see here, and also the film shot in Mexico by Eisenstein, they show a unique cinematographic approach and share an archaeological model of history and an anthropological construction of the gaze. And this brings me, I think we can stop by now showing this video fragment. And this brings me to the next case study. To research these materials further, we ended up in a library in Tbilisi. And it would be my last example of the types of archives you would encounter in Georgia. So for the last 10 months, so it's quite a recent initiative that we decided to work in the, and we have been conducting a library study, as I would call it, working with the archives and a variety of literary journals and periodicals published in Tbilisi between 1917 and to 1930, as well as writings and ephemera from the collection of the Josep Grishashvili Library Museum. Grishashvili is a creative force whose work spans a wide variety of fields. He was a poet, a prompter, an actor, an author of original and adapted plays, a theater historian, a researcher, a chronicler of Georgian literature, a translator, a journalist, a publisher, amongst others. Many of his poems and letters have been published in literary journals, short collections, and anthologies. His collection is frequently referred to as one of the most valuable and largest in the Caucasus, and it contains numerous publications that are not preserved elsewhere. We're talking about more than 100,000 publications and books, which are stored and archived in a tiny house off the radar in the city on the top of a mountain, a place where no one would think that there's such a huge archive preserved. Not many people know of this place in general. And Grishashvili is an example of a literary figure who opted, as I would say, self-historization. He was amassing books, unique documents, and printed matter, as well as photo archive, musical instruments, gramophone records, manuscripts, sound recordings in Georgian, Russian, Armenian, and other languages. His collection comprises materials pertaining to the history, ethnography, culture, languages as well, and related all this politics as well. And this all this was related to Caucasus, Eastern Turkey, Iran, and Southern Russia. The collection's time span is from the 18th to the mid 20th century. I have to mention the reason why I brought this case study as well is because of, again, a connection with Nicolai Marr. Nicolai Marr's paleontology of language eventually served as a methodological and theoretical model for both Grishashvili's poetry and his language studies as well. So his library includes a number of Marr's publications as well as an archive of their of his correspondences, which was donated to the Grishashvili Library. And I think because this material is in Georgian, I don't think that the researchers at the moment have access to this material, but it would be really interesting for them to study this side of Marr's practices and research as well, because they contextualize him very much with Eisenstein, and it would be nice for everyone to get access to the material in this library as well. I would like to mention a bit about his approach. Grishashvili would purchase two or three copies of the same book and use one as a workbook, jotting down notes, comments, and details about his research. A group of researchers later on cataloged and inventoried his entire book collection between, that was, the work was done between 1979 till 1991. And although these catalogs are only in PDF format, so there's just this couple of PDFs that we encounter, I was struck by Grishashvili's annotations, which have been painstakingly studied and incorporated into the descriptions of these various books in the catalog. His writings in these books were themselves occasionally included as pamphlets, fragments of paper, also writings inside the books and on the cover as well. And this enabled me to these PDFs, they actually enabled me to scan and transcribe these catalogs using keywords, permitting a detailed examination of his research interests and also collecting habits as well. I could actually discern a pattern that how he was approaching what he was collecting, etc., through transcribing these catalogs. His writings were used not only for research purposes, but also as personal notes, as I found out. These notes were about his interactions with the period's active figures. While reading the annotations, one has the impression of listening to a conversational piece or a documentation of a particular period, movement, or a process. And I think that was the most interesting, intriguing, and exciting process which I experienced. I've chosen an example, an annotation for a 1924 poetry collection. This, by the way, is the setting, how we work with our team. We work in situ in the archives because most of these houses and these smaller archive institutions, they do not have the facilities to digitize the material themselves. So we go in at a particular point in time and we use their existing infrastructures, we set up our studios and digitize the material, which relate to archive, inventory, and research as well. So this is the example I wanted to bring to talk, to explain further my findings about these annotations that Grishashvili was making. And this is a 1924 poetry collection, Messiah of Donkeys, by Rajden Gvetadze. I present here the registry translation from the library catalog, and I will read it to you now. Page 20, these are annotations that were originally present, and now they're part of the catalog. Page 24, next to the poem Onin, is written, published in 1922. In the poem Ominous Monday, the word Dilas, morning, was changed into Dilit. So he's making editorial suggestions in the publication. page 28, the title of the poem Shoes was underlined and was annotated Mestebi, an old kind of traditional shoe in Georgian. In page 29 in the poem A Night Without Love, the following verse was underlined, but the pencils have blossomed like dead blackbirds, and bears the annotation imitating the poem by Marijani from the journal, and he's citing a journal where he, when one can find the actual poem which was being imitated. The poem My Childhood in the Village bears the following annotation: it's good. And the same is written next to the poem Donkey Fall, Squinting Donkey, and Donkeys in Sledge. And next, finally, next to the poem Odd Bean, it's written a sonnet. So as you can see, these comments vary a lot. Some are categorizing, some add information, and others refer to something completely different. And having research, the reason why I chose this example is because I had recently commissioned an English translation of this poetry publication for Kona Books Publishing in Tbilisi, and I was inspired, in particular, to present. I wanted to present this example, also because I had done such a close reading of this publication as part of another project, I could really much relate to these annotations, and I'm really much aware of what Grishish really is mentioning. Another reason why I chose it is the mention of a female poet, Marijan, in this annotation. And I will mention briefly a bit about her, and this is the last part of this talk, basically. So, Marijan, her original name is Mariam Tremaladze, published her first collection of poems in 1921 and quickly established a reputation as a gifted poet who was unafraid to write openly about erotic feelings, physical and spiritual sensations, and female sexuality in general. In 1920s, Marijan and Grishashvili exchanged erotic poems. Marijan's Soviet biographers largely dismissed her 20s creations, and as a result, her work from that era has received scant attention. However, Grishashvili collected all of her publications, literary journals, and served as an editor to most of her work as well, and an advisor. One of Marijan's lesser known but critically important texts was published in the Artistic and Literary Journal of the Georgian Women Writers. There was only two issues ever published, and the essay of hers touches on significant issues such as the struggles of female writers as well as the author's personal feelings. Marijan's poetry is now being rediscovered, reprinted, translated, and performed on a small scale in Tbilisi. Regrettably, the Grishashvili Library's preservation conditions have deteriorated since 1990. In terms of accessibility, I would classify this collection as semi-public, because despite the fact that it is housed in and it's administered by the public library at the Tbilisi State University, Grishashvili's nephew is the current director and the only employee in the library. That is why family ties and personal relationships influence accessibility to these materials, and these collections have been exhibited sparingly and never outside of Georgia. And by bringing this last example, I would say that it is the most important resource to study Georgian women poets, and I think this is something to really delve into in the future. And thanks to these recent research projects that we were conducting, we were very much inspired to gradually build our own archive and database dedicated to curatorial, artistic, and publishing initiatives. By this, I refer to DINEBA's program and practice. One very good example I wanted to show is this book, which you can later consult after this talk, by Stephanie Serra. It's called Through the Words of Others, which I used for the title of this talk as well, published in 2018. And I will quote her: "Everything is a question of individual case study. There is no absolute rule, no law, but rather partial, fragile, and incomplete attempts not to penetrate a mystery, but rather to understand slightly better the intentions of an artist or a writer in question, thanks to the content of his or her library, which has become an archive. Her work was very much, I was referencing it very much when trying to work on the methodologies and approaches that we would later develop at DINEBA with our team. We do not intend to amass vast image collections through our practice, through this archive digitization activities. Our goal is to collect images exclusively in digital formats and as or reproductions, and to store physical archives and keep these physical archives at artists' estates, at their libraries, at their studios, to allow researchers access to the original context, because we think that is very important. These case studies that I have discussed in this talk have compelled us to develop our own unique archiving methodology that would allow artists, curators, participants of our individual projects to enter their own descriptive notes or metadata into the archives and databases, thus defining and contextualizing their materials and knowledge in their own terms. This would allow us to offer indirect readings, rereadings of our project-related archives, reactivating and extending the effect of individual archiving methodologies, personal notes, annotations, and micro-narratives to produce new forms of associations and, as I said, productive encounters. Thank you. If you have any questions, we can open up.
I don't know how it works with the Q&A.
There is a microphone.
There's a microphone in the audience, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Otherwise, we can also continue beyond this talk as well to discuss everything together. Thank you. I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very nice.